This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of April, and this week the employment data got even worse. We learned on Thursday that 6.6 million Americans had filed initial claims for unemployment benefits during the week that ended March 28. That's twice as many as the prior week, which was itself five times higher than the previous record. 10 million more Americans out of work likely means unemployment already around 10%, and the numbers are still expected to get worse, much like the numbers about the coronavirus outbreak itself. Congress did pass that $2.2 trillion relief package last week, which will help a lot. But a key question is when people will get the money that lawmakers have promised them. The federal government is working hard right now with banks and with state unemployment agencies to get the money flowing. But meanwhile, a lot of people are waiting with reduced income, wondering when they're going to get their checks. We'll talk about that in a moment. Later in today's show, ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Karl will join us to talk about his new book, Front Row at the Trump Show, and about what it's like to be covering the White House during the biggest crisis of Donald Trump's presidency. And we will take a look at what remains of the Democratic presidential nominating contest. Now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So these unemployment numbers are quite jarring. Liz, what do you make of the adequacy of the government response on the economic front so far?
I think it's kind of unprecedented territory that we're in. I think typically when we think about bailouts, we think about getting the economy to go. And what we're actually trying to do right now is getting it to stop. We want to get people enough relief and assistance that they don't have to, engage in the market, so to speak, to stay alive, because that requires them to go out in public and increase contact with other people. And that's what we're trying to avoid. So it's kind of difficult to compare it to past efforts. I think that it's sufficient for now, which is what a lot of the progressives in Congress said. It's good enough for now. It's a start. I don't think it will be sufficient all the way to the end. And I think we'll need much more relief before this is over.
Yeah, Rich, what Liz is alluding to there is the phase four. This is the third piece of coronavirus response legislation. And a lot of people in Washington are talking about the need for another one. Nancy Pelosi has a list of things Democrats want. The president himself said that states are going to need some sort of support to get through this crisis. The Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has been talking about that maybe the money that's in this last package to go to small businesses as loans that will be forgiven if those small businesses keep their employees on payroll. So it's a policy designed to keep people employed. That there may not be enough money for that. We may have to go back and appropriate more. So it seems like we might need a phase four. But the signals we've been getting from Mitch McConnell and from some other Republicans in Congress is that they're not that eager about a phase four. What do you think the outlook is for that? I mean, I feel like the pattern historically has been that, you know, what Trump wants, eventually Republicans in the Senate come around to.
There'll be a phase four just as a matter of reality. If, say, we're really going to open back up mostly, you know, by Easter weekend, maybe what we've done would be sufficient. But it's clear it's going to stretch beyond that. Even when we start opening up, the effects of the recession likely will linger. So Congress will end up spending a boatload of money more. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And then what do you think in terms of what needs to be in that? The conversations that, you know, do you want them to be giving money to state governments? Do we need more money to private employers? What are you looking for in a stage four?
I mean, basically more of the same. Maybe states and localities do need more. But I look at all this as basically a bridge to get people through. So I'm not enamored of another thing Trump was talking about this week, which is a big infrastructure project, as he has periodically throughout his presidency, and his theory as well, you know, interest rates are zero, so we can borrow a lot of money, but we're going to be borrowing an enormous amount of money just to pay for the basic relief we need. So my approach would be just to keep doing that and apply as necessary.
Liz, you mentioned that a lot of progressive commentators think this is big enough for now with the expectation that we'll need more later. I've been hearing some disappointment from some commentators about the lack of big structural reforms in here, that you have all this aid for companies and it doesn't tell them that they need to pay a higher wage. It doesn't have, you know, big labor reforms or that sort of thing in here. Do you think, I mean, obviously a big challenge here is this package needs to be full of stuff that you can take out of the box and do right away. It's really difficult to draw up a big long-term reform of the economy. economy like that. But if, as you describe, this is a process, there's going to be more of this legislation, is there a place for bigger, longer term ideas in these responses? And if not, is there anything that progressives should be doing to say, you know, this crisis points out why we need these bigger, long term agenda items, and what's the right time to roll those out?
Yeah, I understand that disappointment. I think it's fair. I know that progressives don't want to see, you know, essentially gigantic corporate bailouts. There have been some comparisons to the 2008 financial crisis bailouts, especially by commentators like Matt Stoller, who pointed out that, you know, those bailouts really went to rescue banks instead of homeowners who had been preyed on by lenders. So, I mean, I certainly understand that kind of frustration that these corporations are essentially holding their workers hostage and saying, we're not going to be able to take care of these people, you need to bail us out. And then the government is doing that, but it's not ensuring any kind of long-term relief for the employees. I do think that is a problem. I think there are a number of ways of remedying it. I also think that this crisis is going to be a long one. And I think that it's going to be a crisis that provides a historical turning point in how we do policy in the United States. That's just a guess. I could be completely wrong, but I'm seeing a lot of people who, you know, heretofore would never have considered advocating for, you know, direct cash payments to Americans, folks like maybe Tom Cotton, who now seem to be fairly warm to that idea, and progressives who have been in favor of that sort of thing for a long time seem emboldened to argue for even more. I think that those are positive signs that we're going to be able to change things for the better if we continue to treat this crisis as seriously as it deserves to be treated. So I do think those critiques are valid. I hope that we address them. I have faith in an ongoing response, I guess.
Rich, what have you been focused on this week?
Well, I think what's happened the last couple of weeks just brings into relief the serial crises over the last 3 years weren't really crises, most of them. I think even the constitutional crisis of the impeachment wasn't very serious because there's zero chance of Trump getting convicted by the Senate. I think the underlying offense wasn't that severe. We litigated that extensively last year. But this is the a real crisis that makes all of that pale by comparison. Now, there's been an argument out there that, you know, Trump was distracted by impeachment. Mitch McConnell has said this. You know, there's clearly something to that, but the CDC would have messed up the testing regardless. Trump probably would have minimized the crisis because he feared, you know, the economic effect regardless. But certainly our political elite as a general matter was distracted by impeachment. Joe Scarborough of Morning Joe said the other day that everyone was warning. Everyone knew this was coming in early January. And then you go back to all his January shows and all his January tweets, and it's entirely about impeachment. So maybe if impeachment hadn't happened, maybe he actually would have talked about this more. Now, that's not a reason for Congress shouldn't feel obligated never to impeach a president because a horrific crisis might crash upon our shores. But I do think this puts everything that's come before in perspective.
You wrote a column about this week, and near the end of it, you say how Trump performs now, finally without Mueller or impeachment, artifacts of another time dogging him, will determine how this time is remembered. And so that's, you wrote that in a column on March 31st, which is 3 months after the virus was first reported in Wuhan, more than 2 months after the first reported U.S. case. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy tweeted on February 5th, which is 8 weeks ago, that he had, quote, just left the administration briefing on coronavirus, and bottom line, they aren't taking this seriously enough, unquote. The president was still comparing this disease to the flu in late February. And the reason I lay out that timeline is, you know, obviously it's not the case that everybody knew this was coming and the president was the person with his head in the sand. There were a lot of people in both political parties who weren't focused on it enough at the time. But there were people who were focused on it at the time, both in politics and in the bureaucracy. And this is above all the president's job. And so, I mean, I guess my question is how he performs now what's going to drive how he's remembered, or is it too late for him to be remembered as having handled this well? Because the early actions are the ones that you really need to prevent over 100,000 deaths in the U.S. And so I think, you know, I think it's possible that the president has finally adopted a worldview on this where he understands the seriousness of it. But that he is so late, I feel like, precludes him from actually having a successful approach to this.
I'm not sure that's true. It's certainly true that people were warning of this within the bureaucracy and some on the outside, especially on the Republican side, Tom Cotton, who was leaving the impeachment trial and going out in front of cameras and trying to talk about this. But there's no doubt that Trump minimized it at the beginning. That was very bad, and everything should have happened a week or two earlier. But I don't think Trump is the only one who was tardy. You look across the world, the reactions to this. South Korea gets high marks in part because they were scared by one of these prior epidemics and to really being prepared for the next one, in part because they're a small country, in part because the outbreak was largely centered on one church, so relatively easy to control. The Germans are very early in testing. Their fatalities are very low. That might be part of the factor. Also, for whatever reason, the epidemic there seems to be centered on young people, which helps in health terms. But everywhere else you look, it was too late. And I think part of it is just the sheer cost involved and how radical. You know, we've already sort of gotten used to this, but it felt radical 2 weeks ago, or whatever it was, to shutter an entire economy and the real human cost to that. So I think everyone's hesitant to do it until they really see the downside effects of the virus. And the problem is, Anthony Fauci has constantly pointed out, by the time you're really seeing it in the numbers, it's too late and you should have acted sooner. So perhaps San Francisco, you know, on our shores, gets the highest marks for acting fastest and seems to have squelched it. Let's at least, fingers crossed, the numbers don't trend back up. But I think it's not just Trump's unique failings certainly played a role here. It's just a natural political and bureaucratic tendency to avoid extreme and radical steps until they seem absolutely necessary.
Liz, what do you make of that?
I think that the radical steps are absolutely necessary. One of the things that's difficult, and you know, I'm not an epidemiologist. I did study medieval Christianity in my graduate studies, and a big part of that was studying the late medieval period and the Black Death, the bubonic plague. So I'm familiar with being extremely freaked out by these massive epidemics. But one of the things that you note there and here, quarantine is a word we get from the response to those late medieval plagues, for instance, is that you have to do things early on when it seems completely irrational and an overreaction in order to keep them from becoming as bad as they possibly can be. So those early responses of extraordinary severity. In the Middle Ages, that would mean if a ship coming into harbor had any sick person on it, or even a rumor of a sick person being on it, it would be quarantined in harbor for 40 days, no one going in or out, which would often be a death sentence for everyone on the boat. But that would be much better than allowing them to come into a crowded port city and then having plague sweep the entire continent, as did happen several times. So I think we're in the same position where it's difficult to make the case to a very populous country consisting of lots of different kinds of people that we need to take these radical measures when nothing really seems to be going that wrong, right? We have a few people coming back from a cruise ship, say the Diamond Princess, who are sick. That's probably the point at which we should have been taking the kind of radical measures that we're taking now. It would have been difficult to make that case, but if we had done it, we probably wouldn't be in the position we're in.
Liz, you had a quite touching column this week. Could you talk a little bit about what you wrote?
I think that these pandemics are an opportunity to think about our moral composition as much as our political one. And since my colleagues and many others are covering the politics of it really well, I wanted to look at the kind of human story going on underneath. And one of the moral stories we've been getting since this all began is you don't really need to worry too much because it's only old people and sick people who are dying of this disease. It's true that it seems like elderly people and people with pre-existing conditions are much more severely affected by COVID-19. But that didn't come as a comfort to me, at least not the more I thought about it. Those lives are extremely valuable as much as anyone's. And the experience of those people and their families as they face this illness, I thought, deserves some examination. So I spoke to a woman whose father was going through chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer. It wasn't stage 4 or anything. He looked like he had a pretty good prognosis, supposing that he survived getting chemotherapy, which damages the immune system during a pandemic. I spoke to him on a Sunday, and I was preparing the piece for publication, and the following Sunday, he died. He went into respiratory distress and he passed away. So because we don't have much testing going on, it's not clear if it was COVID-19. There are a lot of deaths right now that are probably similar to that. I spoke to a priest at a nursing home today, for instance, who had attended many deaths, but it was hard to say if they were COVID-related or not. But those lives are just as valuable as anyone else's. And if we walk away from this feeling like it's not such a big deal if old people and sick people dying, then the disease will have negatively affected our moral health as much as anything else.
Rich, I found kind of strange the talking points that you've heard from certain right-wing media personalities, at least until a few days ago when the president was sending the signals about taking this very seriously that I think has moved some people in that space, but basically saying, you know, death is part of life and you can't let it get in the way and force us to shut down the whole economy. Even the Republican lieutenant governor of Texas said something about he would be willing to die in order to protect the country as a whole. It just feels really weird from a party that is supposed to pride itself on being a party of life.
Yeah, and it's just been a product and part of wanting to follow the president's initial line, and part instinctively rejecting whatever the media is saying at any given moment. But it's a product of just wanting to minimize the severity of this disease. And I endorse Liz's sentiments on this entirely. Certainly true, you know, we naturally kind of feel more of a loss when a 20-year-old dies as opposed to a 90-year-old, and it's worth knowing that this disease tends to hit people with pre-existing conditions much harder, but that's not uniformly true, as we've learned. And also, the definition of pre-existing conditions is quite wide. It includes some people with asthma can readily die from this, but the point that all life is valuable is absolutely true. I've had reason to spend a lot of time with debilitated people in a nursing home suffering from dementia recently, and even folks who must seem like shells of what they once were in the primes of their lives, there's still a spark of personality there. They're totally unique. If you care to, you can make a connection to them. And this disease is just so cruel in the way it preys on human gatherings and human families. One reason Italy's been hit so hard is probably because families spend a lot of time together, so generations are spending time together and rubbing elbows. And then once you have it, you go to a hospital, and there are no visitors. You're intubated. You can't talk. No one's going to hold your hand when you're dying. No one's going to sing a song to you. No one's going to pray with you. You're going to be surrounded by very well-meaning people, but strangers who are overstressed and dressed in spacesuits. And it's just heartrending to think of people dying that way and of families losing loved ones that way.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The New York Times to talk about The Trump Show with Jonathan Karl from ABC News. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. And we're joined now by Jonathan Karl, who is chief White House correspondent for ABC News. John is also president of the White House Correspondents Association, and he's written a new book called Front Row at the Trump Show. Hello, John.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. So I'm going to have a few questions for John at the top of this segment, and then we will bring in Liz and Rich. John, I wanted to ask first about what it's been like covering the White House the last few weeks. This White House has obviously been extraordinarily adversarial to the press, and through at least official channels has tended to be less accessible. They did away with daily press briefings. But now you have the president and the vice president briefing virtually every day, often for well over an hour. And yet in this weird circumstance where you've had to reduce capacity in the White House briefing room, are you finding these briefings useful? What are you getting out of this administration at a time when information is so crucial?
First of all, this has been a truly surreal experience to be going to the White House, and you have to go through the temperature checks to get on White House grounds, and again to get into the briefing room. The temperature checks, theoretically part of public safety, although I don't know what exactly they tell you except whether or not you have a fever. They certainly don't tell you whether or not you have coronavirus. But to go into these briefings and see the president there, sometimes his briefings last for a full 2 hours, and they are in a briefing room that is usually packed. And in my experience, and I've had the opportunity to cover four different presidents, anytime there is a president in the briefing room, it is one of the most crowded places on the planet because you have only 49 seats, but then you have as many other reporters who can squeeze in as possible in the aisles and in the back, and photographers and all of that. And what we have had to do to ensure our ability to continue to cover this story and to cover his briefings is to radically scale back the number of reporters there. So I am now, when I am there, and we all kind of take turns because there's a limited number of seats, there are 14 reporters, and that's it. 14 reporters, and a single, and the camera coverage is all limited number of cameras. So he is holding these briefings to a virtually empty room, the most crowded place in the room, and the only place that is clearly not in compliance with CDC guidelines on social distancing is the podium, where the president and the vice president, Fauci and Burks and whoever else they've brought in for that day is. So that's been bizarre. But also, you're right, it's been at times incredibly adversarial. I had the president, go after me in a rather personal way when I asked what I thought was just a basic question about ventilators. I've seen him, go after my colleagues, Michelle Sindor and Peter Alexander and others. But that's kind of par for the course. The bizarre situation is to see him there every day in briefings that sometimes provide really incredibly important information and sometimes sound like a toned-down version of what he might say at a political rally.
I want to ask you about Sharpiegate, which probably sounds like a weird thing to talk about right now, but you were sort of at the center of that. And one thing you say in the book is that it's, being stubbornly wrong about the trajectory of a hurricane isn't anything like sending thousands of Americans to die in the Middle East. It sort of became one of these classic Trump media fights where the fight seemed to overtake and scale the underlying matter. But I'm wondering what you think about that in light of the president's handling of coronavirus, because it seems to me like the president's willingness to reshape expert guidance in his own mind or on a piece of paper there. Nobody died in Alabama because of that, but maybe that was a warning sign that we should have seen about how he would handle something like coronavirus, where at times he has been very reluctant to accept the expert guidance he's been given.
I think that's a very interesting point. This is something I actually highlight in the book, not because I thought it was a grave and terrible thing that he did, but because I thought it was a rather trivial thing that the media writ large, news organizations, blew out of proportion. And I wrote that as somebody who was the first network correspondent to mention the Alabama miscue in a story I did. I mentioned it kind of low down in a story that ran in the evening news, World News Tonight on Labor Day. And it so infuriated the president that I mentioned that the National Weather Service had corrected him when he said that it was going to hit Alabama. They put out that tweet, a short while later saying, no, it's not coming to Alabama. He actually called me into the Oval Office, and I spent nearly an hour with him in the Oval Office, where much of the meeting was consumed. And I'd never written about it before the book. It's a really surreal experience to be in the Oval Office with him, talking to me about a relatively trivial point that I had made in a piece that ran on a holiday. And he, for some reason he had seen and took offense. And it led to this week where it dominated news coverage because he kept on insisting the hurricane could go to Alabama. The experts kept on saying, no, it's not going to go to Alabama. And of course he broke out the Sharpie and he doctored in a rather clumsy way, probably more meant to be funny than serious, to show the hurricane trajectory hitting Alabama. But you're right. This was a case where the experts were saying one thing, he was saying something else, and maybe made an inadvertent mistake in the beginning. But when he was called out on the mistake, what mattered more than being accurate was proving to the world that he couldn't be wrong. And you know, now we, we see this situation where the all of us are looking to the information that's coming from our federal government, from him, but also from his people, and we need to be able to trust the information. This is more important than whether or not the hurricane force winds hit Alabama. This is like, how do we behave and how do we protect our families in the face of this pandemic?
I mean, Hurricane Maria also seems on point here for me, that the president, I think, had some success as a public relations matter with trumpeting the very early death numbers, saying, you know, only 16 people died in Hurricane Maria, when that was a very early official count, and everyone knew that was nowhere close to comprehensive. And eventually we learned that thousands of people had died because of the storm, but it was way later, and everyone had moved on politically. It seemed to me like that was the strategy he was trying to run on coronavirus for a time, and it took him a while to figure out that wasn't going to work.
Because what he cares about, first and foremost, no matter what the circumstance, no matter how serious or trivial the situation, what he cares about is how it's going to be publicly perceived. And he sees these in numbers, whether it's his poll ratings, the number of people that show up at a rally, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or a death count. And that, I was with him when he visited Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, and I remember just being blown away when he was congratulating the governor of Puerto Rico on the relatively low death numbers, fewer people than Katrina by far. And of course, as you pointed out, we all knew that the numbers were, you know, were artificially low because they just didn't have a visibility on how bad the devastation had been. But that's the way he views things. And when he came out on, it was February 27th, this is just over a month ago, he came out and said there were only 15 coronavirus cases in the United States and it's soon going to go to zero, I think. You know, that's the way he saw the numbers. And then he visited the CDC a short while later, and there was the case of the cruise ship coming into the Bay Area in California. And he acknowledged before the cameras that he really didn't really want it to come because his numbers would go up.
One thing that I'm interested in that you talked about in the book is John Kelly's tenure in the White House and his fairly explicit strategy of managing up to the president, trying to stop him from doing things that Trump, in fact, wanted to do, and sort of talking surprisingly openly to people about this. That's not been Mick Mulvaney's strategy until very recently, serving as acting chief of staff in the White House. Do you think the response to the coronavirus crisis would be going differently if John Kelly were still the chief of staff?
It depends which version of John Kelly, because he had some success early on in terms of managing the flow of information and papers and people to the president and into the Oval Office. And he really did try to control him. One of the interesting moments in writing this book was when I called John Kelly. He had said that he didn't want to talk to me for the book. And I called him again because I had so many. I've got these comprehensive notes from his time as chief of staff because I spoke to him many times off the record, and he spoke to reporters off the record with some regularity. But it was off the record. And I had one specific incident that I describe in the book that I wanted to see if I could at least report what he had told me off the record way back when. And he shocked me by saying that I could use anything that he had told me in real time off the record. So you see kind of littered through the book, when he came in, he was telling people like me explicitly that what he was doing day to day was to try to prevent the president from doing things that were self-destructive. You know, he's got one thing he told me early on, that the story of my first few weeks are tweets not sent, decisions not made. He was explicit about setting up guardrails and channeling the president to do constructive things and keeping him from doing things that were destructive. And that completely went out the window once, you know, even while he was still chief of staff, the president finally kind of like didn't want it anymore and was blowing off John Kelly. And Kelly was basically coming to work every day, but not acting as chief of staff. And then Mulvaney comes in, and I tell this thing. There's another story I found out that I just couldn't believe. He had a retreat at Camp David just after he became acting chief of staff with the senior staff of the West Wing, and he started reading to these senior advisors to the president, senior officials, a book called A First Rate Madness, and he recommended people read it. And it's a book that makes the case that the best leaders in history have been mentally ill. So the subtext is he's saying essentially, you may think Donald Trump is crazy. Maybe he is crazy, but in craziness is brilliance. And, you know, we have to, you know, basically let Trump be Trump. And he's going to handle this a lot better than the most brilliant, insane advisors. So, Mulvaney was explicit about never trying to channel the president. It was diametrically opposed. And this crisis hit, by the way, just as Mulvaney was fired. And he was still technically on the job, but he wasn't there. And, Mark Meadows didn't become chief of staff formally until this week. So throughout the beginning of this, the whole early weeks of this month and a half of this crisis, there was essentially no chief of staff in the White House.
Rich, do you have a question for John?
Yeah, an observation and a question. First of all, John, congratulations on the book. I've sort of been struck, the comparisons between this potentially and President Bush's handling of Katrina, and a similarity between Bush and Trump, although it comes from really different places, is George W. Bush was very reluctant to throw anyone else under the bus beneath them, to fire people, to hold them accountable in a timely way, because he was such a selfless person and was so loyal to everyone under him to a fault. That was the root of the heck of a job brownie statement that was hung around his neck forever during the initial stages of Katrina. Whereas Trump, there's sort of been the same effect with the testing debacle, but from a totally different place, right? He takes any criticism as a personal affront and an insult to him, so he's going to be defensive about it, and hasn't given any indication he's going to hold anyone accountable in the testing debacle, or even admit that anything went wrong. But kind of the it shakes out sort of the same. But John, I was sort of wondering, does Trump like reporters, despite the constant confrontations we see in public? Is that hour-long session in the Oval Office where you guys are discussing in great detail whether the hurricane's going to hit, was forecast to hit Alabama or not, is that a warm and amusing and kind of friendly thing? And do reporters, despite their disregard for Trump and his politics, and also their confrontational attitude a lot, do they like Trump, or at least are they entertained by him?
That's such a great question, Rich, and with it a real central truth about Donald Trump, which he actually really likes reporters. He charms reporters. First of all, he knows most of the people over there, knows them by name. Barack Obama, by the way, you got the sense for most of the time he really couldn't stand the press, and particularly the White House press corps, and didn't know most of the people that covered that building. Donald Trump knows our stories, knows something about us. When he's around reporters, he asks questions sometimes to get a sense. He's somebody who, with regularity on Air Force One, will invite — there's 13 reporters that travel in the press pool on Air Force One, and those seats, change the networks and the newspapers take turns. And he on several occasions has brought the entire group of reporters up to his office in the front of the plane just to kind of talk, or even someone who's watched television. This is something that, trust me, never happened with Obama, and I don't believe happened with Bush either. And Bush had generally good relations with reporters as well, even as he also complained a lot about the coverage. I've been cabinet, I've gone into him for these, they bring in the pool at the network pool, and it's a group of a similar, like 13 to 20 people, depending on what event we're being brought in, to do a photo op. With Obama, those events, say it's like an Oval Office meeting with a foreign leader, at the end of the meeting or at the beginning of the meeting, the press is brought in, a couple of opening statements, very short, are made, some photos are taken, and everybody says thank you, and the press is escorted out. As you've seen with Trump, those sometimes have turned into 20 or 30 or 40 minute free-flowing press conferences. So he's not actually meeting with the foreign leader one-on-one. He's spending most of the time allotted for that meeting with the press because, frankly, he enjoys it more. That said, I've had him scream profanities at me. I describe a frightening scene in the book from the campaign. I've had him, he's berated me in public. He's berated me in private. But for most of the interactions, he's tries to be incredibly charming and complimentary. And as far as the press, this is in some ways a, you know, it's been an exhausting experience to cover anybody who's been at the White House or who survived that campaign. It's exhausting. It can be occasionally maddening because you see Trump say such terrible things about you. You see him urge his supporters to taunt you at his rallies. Those are not comfortable things. You see him describe real good journalism as fake news. That is maddening. But in many ways, it's been an exhilarating story. I mean, it's he is unpredictable. It's the definition of news. Usually covering the White House, you're facing stage managed events, carefully rolled out policy announcements, stuff that is actually, it can actually be a very boring beat because it's a very predictable beat. That has not been the case under Donald Trump.
Liz, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was speaking to one of my family members who has to watch these briefings for work, not media work, but in the healthcare related field. And he said, you know, it's like watching Castro, in that these things go on and on and on for like a couple of hours. Is Trump trying to do some kind of fireside chat thing with this coronavirus update show? Why is it so long and meandering?
I'll tell you. I mean, I was there one Friday, and as we got into approaching 8 o'clock, I was like, you know, I was thinking to myself, I want to go out and have some dinner. I mean, it's like it's unbelievable. I mean, and again, with a small group of reporters to see literally clock in at 2 hours, and sometimes he says goodbye to the experts, and then he continues to stay there and hold forth. I think that one of the things that's going on here is he's going a little stir crazy having to stay in the White House. And I think that, you know, he is a guy who has always gotten a jolt out of going and doing the rallies. I mean, he did a campaign rally before he was after the election and before he was sworn in as president, because he needs it. He feeds off that energy. He likes to get out there, and he likes to be he likes to be on the stage and performing. And so I think there's a little bit of that. And I think that to an extent, this has replaced those rallies, which obviously he can't do right now. It's not to say it's not a serious message. This isn't pure politics, but there's a healthy dose of politics in all of these. And once he's got the spotlight, he does not like to relinquish it. He's there, and he, you know, I mean, sometimes you get the sense that he's got more. I mean, he could stay for another hour, and you know, you can look around the room. I've been tempted. You remember Helen Thomas used to always, in the press secretary briefings, when she felt it was time to end, she would say, "Thank you." And I've been tempted to, on occasion, throw out a little bit of a thank you to the president, but it's, you know, it's not really my place to do that.
So then do you have any thoughts on what this is likely to look like in terms of the president's PR approach as this crisis continues on for what's likely to be a long time? I mean, it seemed to me that a constant through this is that it looks like getting reelected is top of mind for him, and his sense keeps changing of what will help him with that, you know, downplaying the crisis, then showing you're taking it seriously, then trying to reopen the economy. And then I think now his view is that his only way to win again is to be seen as having done a good job fighting this. But what is, you know, what does that look like as we get closer to the election?
I would look for continued wild fluctuations in how he handles this. I think that you've described exactly his approach. He downplayed it. He talked about, you know, going back, churches being filled on Easter because he felt that this is what people wanted to hear. And then, you know, on one sense, he listened to the experts who showed him just how dire it could be if they took that approach. But I think he also got a sense from the polling, which he continues to monitor very, very closely, that people are freaked out and, are afraid and want to see strong and decisive action on this. And then he comes out and he has an entirely different tone at the very next briefing. But I think he's gonna waver on this. I think that the instinct that we saw when he was talking about we're gonna be done with this soon, I think that is still where he is. But he's gotten a sense that if he is seen as not listening to the experts. And I think that what's gonna drive him first and foremost is how it is perceived publicly, the way it is depicted in the news media, which he derides, and what he is seeing in the polling on this. I think that's going to drive him.
Jonathan Karl is chief White House correspondent for ABC News, and his new book is called Front Row at the Trump Show. John, thank you very much for joining us.
Great. Thank you very much. Great talking to you guys.
I will be back with Liz Brunig of the New York Times and Rich Lowry of National Review to talk about the Democratic presidential race. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. There is still a presidential election ongoing. The Democratic National Committee is going to move the Democratic Convention from July to August. There are no longer any Olympics to worry about running into a time conflict with. And the Democratic presidential primaries have mostly been paused. A number of states have been moving them back, although Wisconsin is expected to vote next week. Still, we will see how that works operationally. Liz, I'm just wondering, it's this sort of weird zombie campaign, right? I mean, it's over, but it's not over. And I'm wondering, is that the view of people on the left? Is there a recognition? I mean, because the polling gap has only gotten somewhat wider in Joe Biden's favor as this crisis has gone on. So what is the objective here for Bernie Sanders and his supporters?
Well, Sanders says he has a narrow path. There was some excitement about the prospect of him potentially dropping out among centrists a while back when he said he was going to Vermont to reassess his campaign, but he didn't, and I doubt he will. I assume Sanders is going to the convention just like he did last time. It's strange. The entire presidential race, not just the Democratic primary, but the general as well, has been, I think, overtaken by a sense of futility. And pandemics bring a sense of futility. That's one of their hallmarks. It seems like the Democratic primary is a foregone conclusion. It also seems to me like the general election is a foregone conclusion. I in my gut, and I could be completely wrong. I was wrong before. I didn't expect Trump to win in 2016. But I have a hard time imagining anything is going to happen other than Trump crushing Biden.
Really?
So a crisis favors an incumbent. And Biden has sort of just stopped campaigning. Trump is still, rhetorically at least, quite acute. Biden is not at all. Trump is going to be in the middle of managing this crisis. And I have to assume it'll be somewhat analogous to a war. When a president is in the middle of managing a war, people appear to like to give him the chance to finish that, especially if we continue to see public approval of Trump's handling of the coronavirus crisis it go up and up and up. In that case, I just have a hard time seeing Biden, who can't really finish a sentence and whose campaign couldn't figure out how to live stream, whose appearances have just been kind of without any kind of energy, a little bit tired and weary and overwhelmed. I just have a hard time seeing him whip up the energy necessary to overtake Trump. I mean, it's possible, but given everything that's going on.
I think that is completely wrong, and I will lay out why. So, I mean, first of all, this is largely the analysis that we heard of Biden in the primary, that he, you know, is terrible on the stump, bad in debates, has no enthusiastic supporters. He's not a choice that excites anybody. And he managed to come out of nowhere and clobber Bernie Sanders in South Carolina. And then when other candidates dropped out, it wasn't just that they endorsed Biden, it's that, their supporters listened to them and went to Biden. And I think it reflected a desire among a majority of the Democratic electorate for a less interesting choice, for someone who was more moderate, more about ending the Trump situation rather than about radically reorienting the nature of U.S. government. I think that message, it's not very exciting. It's not very fun, but it proved to be popular with the electorate, and that the his performance on the stump and performance in debates is clearly good enough, because it was good enough for him to get to this commanding position that he's in the primary. And then I think as for the general election, Biden continues to lead Donald Trump in national polling. The poll bounce that President Trump has gotten is actually quite small when you compare it to other world leaders and also to governors in the United States. The president's had a handful of points of increase in his approval rating. It's normal to have a rally around the flag effect. It's usually much larger. We're seeing, if you look at Emmanuel Macron or Angela Merkel, you're seeing, large double-digit increases in Italy. Prime Minister Conte, his approval rating is up by something like 40 points. So I think that actually is a quite alarming sign for the president, that even in a crisis like this, even with him getting all this airtime and being able to show himself in whatever way Donald Trump can as being in command in a crisis, it's actually persuaded very few people, and those effects tend to fade. And then I think as for, the Biden campaign, him not getting out there that much, when you're in the lead, sometimes the right thing to do is to run a dull, conservative, defensive campaign. And nobody ends up really liking that. The media doesn't like it because it's boring. Partisans don't like it because they, they like the party. They want to hear a positive message about what you're going to do. But if you're running against an unpopular incumbent, sometimes the best thing to do is to just sit back and let people watch him and see what they didn't like about him. I mean, this was Chris Christie's campaign for governor of New Jersey in 2009, that, he was running against John Corzine. John Corzine was unpopular. Chris Christie kind of said as little as possible about what he would do as governor to try to keep the race as much of a referendum on Corzine as possible. Took some criticism from conservatives who wanted him to make more promises about what he would do. And he ends up beating Corzine. And so I think that, I think Biden has actually been disciplined in running this campaign that doesn't have an adoring constituency for it, but clearly has been able to perform very strongly in these primaries. So I think that, I think that if you're the sort of person who thought that Biden was going to be a disaster in the primary, you should be asking yourself a little bit what you missed about the primary and whether you're misapplying that analysis to the general.
Well, right. And so, I did expect Biden to be a bomb in the primary. I'll give you that, because he can't, for various reasons. But I don't know. I think that among other issues, Biden is going to have to get the significant portion of people who voted for Bernie Sanders to vote for him. I don't see that happening. The nation's very polarized. Trump is very unpopular. We're in the midst of this crisis. It hasn't ended yet. So I would give Trump a little more time to perform. Italy, for example, and France and Spain and so forth, they're further into their experience with this in a lot of ways than we are. The crisis has not peaked in the United States yet. It won't for several weeks. Of course, it'll peak in different states at different times. I think another problem is the crisis has disrupted the Democratic primary process to such a degree that people who probably already felt it was largely illegitimate are now totally convinced the outcomes are illegitimate. Right now, there's a battle going on with Biden telling people in Wisconsin to go vote in person. The Sanders campaign seems to be advocating an all-male election. The Biden campaign won't have it. And so I think that there's going to be an enormous amount of dissension and disunity in the party at the end of this. And maybe Biden doesn't need Bernie's people to vote for him to win the general. I would think that that would create similar issues for him as it did for Clinton in 2016. And I think his enthusiasm, the enthusiasm Biden people have for him, is similar to the enthusiasm people had for Clinton in 2016, which proved to be a problem for her. So a lot of different ways it can turn out. At this point, it does seem Biden seems totally resigned. And it's possible that's just sort of like three-dimensional chess, that he's just sort of letting Trump self-destruct. I'm not sure how it's going to work out. So the whole thing kind of feels futile to me, and I'm not sure what's going to happen. It just seems like another blow to the kind of legitimacy of the entire Democratic process that has kind of been in slow breakdown for a while now.
Rich, what do you make of this?
Well, I was in the camp that Liz was in the primary. I thought Biden was kind of pathetic. And, you know, he was kind of pathetic. He, you know, had some okay debates. He showed great perseverance, which is to his credit. He understood where the center of gravity was within the Democratic Party more than a lot of other people did. So he deserved credit for those things. But he just wasn't a great candidate. He never generated crowds, never generated enthusiasm. And this is where Josh is right. It didn't matter. People were self-motivating, and it wasn't entirely driven by the desire to beat Donald Trump and the belief that even though Biden's failings are manifest and no one's that affirmatively excited about him, he had the best chance of doing it. And I think if he wins the general, it'll likely be the same phenomenon. It'll be a rejection of Donald Trump and Joe Biden being not particularly exciting, not particularly impressive, but being acceptable. So my take is he can be bumbling around in his basement looking lost at times and having some very awkward interviews and still very well win this election because he's basically a negative candidate. Not negative in the sense that he's particularly harsh. Actually, he isn't. There are some opportunities he passes up to say really harsh things about Donald Trump. But because if he wins, it's just going to be a negative referendum on the incumbent.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
Again, I'm not really bothered by anything at this point except the idea that parents who are stuck at home shouldn't be doing dependent care. There have been some grumblings I've seen about corporations expressing a little bit of frustration that while they're paying their workers to telework, their workers are in fact doing childcare. Shut up. Oh my God. It is a double job that parents are having to do right now with their kids at home. They're doing their own full-time jobs to keep their money coming in, and they're performing the work that teachers and childcare professionals, some of the most overworked and underpaid people in this country, are doing full-time at the same time. If you're a boss who's bothered that your workers are busy with childcare when they should be on duty, seriously rethink your priorities.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Much of the elite commentariat let its condescension show in mocking the CEO of MyPillow, Mike Lindell, who showed up at a White House event to explain how he was soon going to start manufacturing 10,000 masks a day to help with the coronavirus crisis. This is an eminently praiseworthy and patriotic act. But since Lindell appears in his own kind of cheesy TV ads, is an evangelical who talks openly about his faith, and is a strong Trump supporter, a lot of people dumped on him rather than saying what we should say to anyone of any stripe who's willing to lend a hand in this moment. Thank you. Thank you very much.
For my rant, I just want to say that I was right about the president's relationship with Anthony Fauci, as all these other people were trying to prophesize the end of Anthony Fauci's tenure overseeing infectious diseases for the U.S. government because of his collision course with Donald Trump, with Donald Trump being unable to take Anthony Fauci's high profile and contradicting the president on various matters. That is not what has happened. In fact, what we saw this week is the president finally bending to expert advice, people telling him that if he continued with his reckless idea to try to reopen the country by Easter, that we would have well over a million deaths if he did that. The president listened. He doesn't always listen. I'm not sure that he's going to continue to listen, but I think the reason that he listened, at least in this instance, is because experts like Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci have painstakingly built good enough working relationships with the president that he will at least listen to them sometimes. Now, I'm not sure that he's going to continue listening to them forever. I'm not going to make any warranties about the president's handling of this crisis next week or the week after. He's not the president I would put in charge of this. But President Trump is handling this better than he would if Anthony Fauci was not there convincing the president to listen to him. We should be grateful for that. We should hope that continues as long as possible. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Jonathan Carl. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.